Hi, everyone. I'm Natalie Gochner. You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I represent the political center and have on the political right Representative Ryan Wilcox.
Morning, everybody.
Good to see you, Ryan. And on the political left, Shireen Gourbani.
Hello. And hey, listeners, so appreciate you tuning in. And
That's my favorite when she says it like that.
Yeah. And
well,
in
really
studio
do.
Today with our producer, Anthony Scoma, which we're all excited about.
Yes, it's so fun to have our producer with us in person.
Yeah. But, Ryan, you have been traveling and spent time at the border in part of your role as the chair of the Law Enforcement and Criminal Justice Committee on the Hill. You're focusing on organized crime.
Where were you?
Yeah, we don't often get someone who's been right at the border. Tell us just a quick, summary.
Yeah, quick flight down Sunday to the Tucson sector, down on the border with the Border Patrol. And there is nothing like seeing it in real life, watching people, fleeing one country into another, risking everything to do this, watching the cartels organize themselves, the lookouts on the other side of the border as they monitor everywhere we go. We're watching them report back on our position so that they can tell, the traffickers when we're gone. So now you can go. They can't get to you fast enough. All of these kind of things. There's just nothing like being there in person.
Yeah. Why is this a partisan divide, Ryan? I mean, I'm just saying the idea of organized crime, conducting things on border crossings into our country. Why is that partisan? I didn't get that.
That shouldn't be at all. And gratefully in Utah, with the new organized crime subcommittee on the larger Law Enforcement Criminal Justice Committee, it's not.
Yeah.
Right? We have wonderful members of both the minority and the majority that are participating in that. And, it's not, because frankly, it affects all of us exactly the same, regardless of why this has happened. Certainly nationally, it's turned into that.
Mm-hmm.
But there wasn't a Republican-Democrat divide down on the border in Arizona.
Yeah. Shireen, what are you seeing, what he's saying there?
Oh, so I you haven't spoken directly to this, but I think, one of the things that I feel like is devastating, and again, is across partisan lines, is the impact of drugs, right? Fentanyl, when we think about the number of Utahns that have been lost, of course, nationwide, the numbers are devastating. And also just thinking about the fact that I actually believe there are a number of shared possibilities for response that we could find quite a bit of agreement on, but it has been made into, and I think we try to sometimes go entire episodes without talking about Donald Trump, but it's hard not to bring him up in this context, because I do believe that he wants and has said that he would like the chaos at the border to continue, to be able to use that to drive a wedge. And it is heartbreaking, because people's real lives are at risk. We're losing real people. And just the amount of strain that's put on these communities and these individuals seeking freedom is really, it's stunning.
Mm-hmm. Did either of you see the interview that the president of Mexico gave on this issue, specifically asked about the drug problem? And he essentially said, well, in Mexico, we don't have a drug problem. We have a problem that we're a neighbor to a country that has a drug
problem. Yeah.
Yeah. We have a cartel problem. We don't have a drug problem. And I remember real early on Condoleezza Rice even making some statements when she was in a role of this type, that she said the best way we can help with the border is a healthy
society
that isn't. I mean, Mexico has the misfortune of being our neighbor.
Yeah,
this is not just I totally agree. Supply and demand, right? That's people respond to incentives in all sorts of ways. There are a couple of things, though, that I think are important. What I heard over and over and over again is the failure of the new asylum policy. I heard that from individual agents. I heard that from the chief of the station. I heard that from the immigrants themselves. When I interviewed three of them, they asked if one of us could talk to them. And I was the only one in the delegation that happened to speak Spanish. So that fell onto me. And having those conversations directly with them, different demographics, different population bases. All three of them that I spoke with were from Central and Central America and Mexico. And in all of those cases, they had been trained, they had been coached, they had paid thousands of dollars, in many cases, $10,000 to these cartels. This is about money for them. It's not just the drug thing. The drug thing is also a thing. But this is the lives of people who are desperate that they're capitalizing on from around the country. They're advertising throughout the Middle East. They're advertising throughout China. We've picked up people from countries in the last month at that sector from 64 nations around the world.
Yeah.
They are funneling all of that here, and it's not.
Ryan, can you localize this to North Temple, Salt Lake City, Jordan River, trail Salt Lake City. What do we know about organized crime in our state?
We know that the supply of both drugs and people is fueling a lot of that. And it's sold on the backs of what we hope are the immigrants that are coming here. What we imagine, you know, those who saw the city on the hill and wanted to be a part of it and improve their lives. The problem is it's run and controlled entirely along that southern border by the cartels, mm-hmm. by criminal organizations who have ulterior motives. In other words, to grow their market, mm-hmm. regardless of the cost.
Yeah. You never like to hear, Shireen, the term organized crime.
No.
You know, crime,
no,
crime alone
organized.
Is bad enough.
Yeah.
They're
yeah,
way more organized than corporations here in the United States. The stuff that I saw this yeah. last week.
Yeah. Hey, yeah. we got another border issue. This is, I'm going to take us to Israel, where they have seized the Rafah crossing in Gaza. UN's warning that Gaza could run out of fuel and drinking water this week, even yeah. today.
Hospitals are reporting that they have run out of fuel.
Yeah, and, yeah. yeah. Shireen, give us I know we're sitting here in Utah, but give us the lens on this for both sides
so
of the
one
aisle.
Of the reasons the fuel issue is so critical is so much of the infrastructure, poor infrastructure that exists, is run off of fuel, right? Mm-hmm. So when you think about the need to run hospitals off of fuel, I don't think we think about that in mm-hmm. the United States. Water treatment, sewage, right? Mm-hmm. Like many of these core functions require
yeah, communications.
Require fuel,
yeah.
yes. And these were already substandard systems before
yeah.
this. Cutting these off means that there are hospitals that do not have power. And so we can think about, if you're in a war zone, your hospital now also has no power. Like the ripple effects of this are devastating. And now I think we're starting to see a different response from the United States. It sounds that there are some weapons that have been put on hold. I certainly would like to see more action, but this is, I do think, a step in saying you cannot do this. Like
yeah.
this is going too far.
Ryan, I don't expect you to have this international policy expertise and comment, you know, succinctly on something like this, but are you basically in favor with what President Biden's doing? He's now withholding 3,500 bombs from Israel. He's slowing down the aid.
I think we're far too involved in any of those conversations. In fact, mm-hmm. the fact that we indicated to Iran and Israel how much they could push back against one another, as if we were the puppeteers the entire time, is so morally questionable. I don't even...
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Ryan, did you see President Randall's op-ed in the Deseret News about the protests on the University of Utah campus?
I saw that there was one.
Yeah, yeah. You know, essentially tried to balance the, explain the balance that he seeks between
sure.
protests are absolutely allowed, but you have to do it within the confines of the law.
You know, I read Ben Sasse's.
Yeah, another one. This is the president
comment.
Of the University of Florida.
Yeah, president of the University of Florida. Yeah, I think generally that's the right approach. We promote free speech. We promote, you know, protesting. You're welcome to do that. That doesn't necessarily mean that occupation of a building or a property where it's against the law or not,
yeah.
you know, yours to occupy.
Shireen, I'd love you to comment on this. I do want to say that I did attend graduation at the University of Utah, both two convocations mm-hmm. plus the main, you know, ceremony. And it was we had a great experience on campus, meaning we did have some protests.
Yeah.
They were peaceful.
Yeah.
People walked out as the president was speaking.
Sure.
He acknowledged them and we moved on and our graduates got to be celebrated.
Yeah.
So mission accomplished from that standpoint.
Sure. I think that's important. I'll just say, I think that there is, you know, quite a bit of confusion around what it is that students are asking for.
Mm-hmm.
And our students, right, are asking for divestment. So mm-hmm. one of the things that means is, you know, you hear many students across college campuses saying that they don't want their tuition dollars, the dollars that are coming in endowments, to go towards weapons manufacturing, to go towards supporting key industries that support war. I feel like this is a conversation we should be having all the time,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
To me, it makes sense that institutions of higher education could certainly have diverse portfolios, but that, you know, we may not want to invest those dollars in the dollars of our learning institutions as, you know, the weapons of war. I think that it sounds to me as though the University of Utah's investment portfolio, and this is, I think, true of many mm-hmm. public universities, is mm-hmm. quite different than mm-hmm. that of private universities. So how this all works out, I think, is difficult, right? But I do, I feel like this is an important conversation to advance and to try to understand.
Yeah, yeah. Did you see Ryan, Senator Romney got involved here, basically said if you're a student protester, you shouldn't have your college loan.
Forgiven.
Forgiven.
Yeah, you can still have your college loan, but we're not paying it off for you.
Yeah, did you like that move?
I thought that was interesting, you know, obviously a tie-in here and a little bit of a dig at the president, right, with the college loan forgiveness thing, which he's categorized in the past as bribery. So, yeah, not surprised.
That Romney has.
Yes. I'm not surprised that he did that. But there is a sentiment across the country when you see folks that are, you know, paying for these things to be paid off, watching the institutions be damaged and destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the cleanup from those things is sort of unbelievable.
I read an opinion piece. I believe it was in, well, it was in the Deseret News, but it was also probably in the Washington Post Light, but it was a professor who walked through George Washington University's protests. And she mentioned, I saw all these bright colored tents. And it occurred to me that those tents could be really well used in Gaza right now. And maybe those kids should go back to their college dorms and make sure the aid gets where it needs to go and you know, not
there's
be
so
off
much
on a...
good that could be done. That's one of the hardest things here is we spend all this time yelling and fighting when if we put any of that energy into actually helping solve the problem, how much good could have been done?
Yeah, be good. Hey, let's take a short break, but we've got a lot of news in the second segment. Natalie Gochner with Shireen Gourbani and Ryan Wilcox. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on Utah Public Radio. We love to hear from listeners like you. If you would like to send us a comment, email bsotapodcast@gmail.com. That's bsotapodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Shireen Gourbani on the left.
Ryan Wilcox on the right.
Natalie Gochner in the Political Center, and this is Both Sides of the Aisle. Got a presidential election year. We got talk going on about who might be the presumptive nominee, President Trump's running mate. And news flash this week that there are actually some whisperings about potentially Mike Lee as a vice presidential candidate. Shireen, you're smiling big.
I hate this idea. but I'll just say, I think
it has a symmetry to it, though, based on how the things that Senator Lee's been doing for all these years.
And... Yes. Well, I mean, more recently, right? Mm-hmm. Because I would say post when he tried to run a runaround on the convention floor to not have Donald Trump be the nominee for president. He's certainly come around on that. I just wonder, like, how many times he would text him, just tell me what to say. Or would we continue to, like, see the kind of kowtowing political, like, alignment that Lee has performed in the shadow of this president? But I have to say, Ryan, I bet you have more thoughts on this. Do you think this is real?
Perspective.
Do you think this is a real whisper or not really?
Not at all.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think so at all. In fact, I got back at 2 this morning from D.C. and I didn't hear a single conversation, including with Senator Lee and any of the other members of the delegation about it. So I know I don't think that's real. I also would like just to remind everyone that of the entire delegation, Senator Romney voted with President Trump far more than Senator Mike Lee.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah, it's an interesting stat. Well, just because I think it's fun, President Trump, you know, he's going to carry this out as long as he can, right? This selection process.
Yeah, because why not?
Yeah, who he picks. He's saying of J.D. Vance, the senator that wrote Hillbilly
Elegy.
Yeah.
Which, yeah.
Great book, right? He said, one of the great senators. And then Representative Stefanik, he said, very smart.
Yeah.
We like this one, Shireen. North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum, very rich.
Very rich.
Okay.
Yeah. But then he talks about this Representative Byron Donalds, who's black, and basically says, you know, I like diversity. And then he says, diversite.
Yes. Well, we've seen a little bit of, he is courting diversity somewhat, right? I think about the conversations with Governor Noem that I feel like are quickly going down the drain. And then also Tim Scott of South Carolina as well. So there's been certainly, a desire or maybe some strategy at play in thinking about what it means to bring on a diversité, in Trump's term, to his ticket. So it doesn't surprise me. But I think in the end, I just will be so surprised. I don't feel like we know who it is yet.
And I guess Trump has also referenced Senator Lee's newly shaved head by saying, I love your haircut. Whatever. I want to talk about Senator Lee and TSA, and I think that's a good one for you to lead us out on, Ryan.
Yeah, well, Senator Scott, Rick Scott out of Florida, wanted to adopt a change to the FAA reauthorization to prohibit the TSA from accepting the Customs and Border Patrol app as a form of identification for migrants. This is really the problem, and I heard about this, you know, down in Arizona on Monday, is we're, like we are in Israel, we're funding both sides of this thing. Now, I say we in the royal, we Americans, we're paying for the drugs. We're paying for the fentanyl. That's why there's a market here, because we have major issues. That part is also true, that we are also funneling. We are responsible for fighting this stuff. We're responsible for, you know, not causing the deaths of millions of people, the hundreds of thousands of people, and putting them at risk in order to get to the United States. And in our effort to try to be compassionate, we've now changed our asylum policy, and we are using our own money, meaning FEMA money, our emergency money, to fly these people around the country. Once they get in, if they claim asylum, they're going wherever they can claim they have a sponsor. And we're funding it on the back end and giving them hearings, because there's so many and not enough immigration judges or courts around the country. It's 4 and 5 and 6 years out before they're going to have a hearing. It's not just, we don't not only know where they are, we're not keeping track, we're funneling both sides of it.
They get a work permit in that time. Yeah.
No. And I have to say, like, this for me also taps into one of, I think, the most complicated and heartbreaking components of this is what's happening to children, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think we remember a lot of the outrage during the Trump administration. I don't know that it's honestly gotten much better in recent years, but if kids show up at the border and we don't have any sense of documentation, the way that they get lost in systems is truly devastating. Like, it's horrifying to me. Yeah. And I know that we could do better. We just choose.
Because I'm watching them in tents, like these clear tents, the unaccompanied minor section. I'm standing next to them, looking at them and talking to some of them that would want to talk. But there is no plan. Like, we're coming together. The NGOs are completely overwhelmed there in Tucson and the surrounding area. They don't know how to handle it. And so they're looking for any kind of a connection. The countries won't take them back. Mexico and Guatemala are showing up every day from the consulate to check on these kids to make sure they have what they need, but they won't take any responsibility either. So it's also our partners to the south and these other countries that don't want responsibility for their own children.
I mean, I think we're all implicated in a terrible system here.
Yeah, and meanwhile, we have Marjorie Taylor Greene doing yet another motion to oust Speaker Johnson.
How'd it go?
Yeah, that's crazy.
She lost. So I thought this was interesting because it seemed like a little bit less of a... I know that, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene will say Democrats saved him, but it does seem like the message to Democrats was vote as you wish. Do you want to go back into round after round of trying to get a new speaker, or, you know, do you want to stick with this person who honestly does seem like he's doing, though I again politically could not probably agree less with this individual, but he does seem like he's trying to move government forward.
He has some leadership qualities.
He's trying to make it work.
Yeah. I agree.
Yeah, I agree. I would say every member of our delegation voted to keep him in place, which I was proud of them for doing. And then Republicans and Democrats came together to save Mike Johnson.
All right. We got some endorsements. We got Senator Romney endorsing 3rd Congressional District candidate Stuart Pei. Of course, this is in the race that we have our friend John Dugal in, Mike Kennedy in.
Others. What do we know about Stuart Pei?
Yeah. Do you want to answer that one? Right. Yeah.
My experience with Stuart was he was the party chair, like the Republican Party chair in Utah County, which is a job.
Okay.
And he was great. He was competent. He was a good leader in that time frame. And that's really as much as I know Stuart. The more interesting part to me is that he's now picked up both Chris Stewart's and Senator Romney's endorsements.
Sounds like
race.
Establishment a little bit.
Yeah.
A little bit, but both, you know, heavily emphasized his military background in their endorsements, and Senator Romney with his experience in foreign relations, and obviously Chris Stewart's with his experience in national defense and intelligence. Those are high priorities for them both. And so they believe that that's the right candidate.
So Shireen, Phil Lyman also picked his new running mate. I share a first name with her. This is Natalie Klassen.
Yes.
There's been a lot of Natalies in the news. Natalie Klein, Natalie Klassen.
There have been. Yes. And you, of course, making news.
This new choice lieutenant governor, what do you know about her, Shireen?
So what I know about her is I noticed her, honestly, when the picture came out, I recognized her from some hearings that we had at our legislature this last year that would have reduced our access to the ballot, changes that wanted to be pursued to make it harder to vote in this state. And she was on the side of those restrictions. I was happy to actually see that our legislature continued to largely support vote by mail efforts, like really reaffirm our commitment to safe, secure, and frankly, pretty easy access to vote, like the ability to vote. So I think it would be concerning to see a person who was openly testifying in support or supporting, giving voice to supports to make it more difficult to vote, be in charge of our election system in this state. I don't think that's good.
Ryan, do you think that our Supreme Court got it right in not allowing this Lane Bangeter on the ballot?
Plain language is pretty clear.
Yeah.
Like that was bizarre to me that pick was made. Given the reading of the Constitution, you could argue it a little bit, but there's no way that could have been argued that this is a good idea. The man nominated, he was the elector that nominated President Trump from Idaho 4 years ago.
Yeah.
So that was a strange choice. As far as the other point, I want to address that really quickly. I'm still in the same place I was last week on the elections. I do not believe, in fact, that this is a good example. If this person is not the right person, maybe they shouldn't be on the ticket to be the person in charge of elections. That should be an independent office. It should be something that is nonpartisan.
Yeah, yeah. Ryan, let's stay with you and just give us a sense of what happened with this, bathroom monitor bill that put the state auditor in charge of this. They have now sifted through thousands of frivolous complaints. I guess they have over 4,000 bogus complaints.
Now it's closer to 10.
Is that right?
Yeah.
And Auditor Dougal is like saying, come on, guys.
Yeah, no, I think all of us have spent some time with Auditor Dougal about this topic. To be fair, he wasn't brought into this until it was in the Senate. He didn't really have an opportunity to talk about it in the House because he wasn't part of the bill. They didn't talk to him about it. The other part that is just fascinating is that we really have, these aren't organic complaints. This is an activist group that is going out and intentionally overwhelming the office with 10,000 complaints that are all frivolous.
I'm sure they are so proud of what they're doing because they're making a pretty good, public message here.
Yeah.
Well, it's frustrating, right? And it's frustrating for our offices too. You know, we're happy to investigate real things, but we don't need a bunch of fake ones to worry about.
Yeah, I'll just say that I think, the comment that Dougal made was that this is invasive and overly aggressive legislature making him the bathroom monitor. And I do think that is what happened. This is, to me, just such a deep reach of government into people's personal lives. And the other thing that I think is really upsetting about this bill is that if you're going to require that bathroom, that now we're monitoring, right? So now we're surveilling people and the bathrooms that they're choosing. I think that's wrong. And I feel like it's kind of anti-American. I also feel like the component of it that's frustrating from a person who used to work in facilities is if you're going to now require that there's a non-gendered bathroom, but provide zero funding for that to happen, the government is mandating it, but not creating the pathways for it to be supported. I think this is a mess, and I feel like it is overreach of the government in the purest sense.
Mm, yeah.
There's certainly other ways that could have been addressed.
Couldn't agree more.
Shireen and Ryan, Abravanel Hall is making it in the news. So this is named after Maurice Abravanel had done so much for the Utah Symphony. It's where our, symphony performs. But in the pitch to make a sports and entertainment district downtown in the Smith Entertainment Group plans, they're pushing east and we know that they're interested in changing the Salt Palace, but I didn't know they'd go as far as Abravanel Hall.
Well, I think there are many reasons that this is in the conversation. I'll just say I am with Councilmember Jim Bradley on this one. I do not think that we should lose Abravanel Hall, based around issues of sightline or, maybe that there are upgrades that need to happen to that building. My understanding, one of the biggest challenges is that I've come from facilities, but the HVAC system that is connected into Abravanel Hall is connected into the Salt Palace. Mm-hmm. And there is a massive, probably multi-million dollar upgrade that needs to happen to that system. I also believe that the Salt Palace was probably maybe built for a different vision of what it would need to be in terms of the spacing and size of that. So there are lots of reasons to reconsider the space, but I hope that we get to keep Abravanel Hall.
Yeah. The way I hear of the Salt Palace is we built a church for Easter Sunday because of the outdoor retailers when retailing was the thing and the outdoor retailers was big and large. And that whole west side of the Salt Palace is basically underutilized prime downtown real estate.
Every time there's an essential oil convention, it smells really differently in a Bravenal hall. But no, I just attended a concert there last Thursday night, right? Millennial Choirs and Orchestra. Do you ever have a chance to watch those guys? Incredible. Mm-hmm.
Awesome. Acoustics are amazing.
Yeah, it's awesome. But I also want to mention, too, because of this conversation about the moving, I was part of those conversations and a lot through the legislative session. Those weren't brought up by Smith Entertainment Group. Those were brought up by Salt Lake County and Salt Lake City, who also wanted to consider these upgrades and protect Bravenal Hall in the long term. And I think that's where that even came from. And Smith Entertainment bought it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I just think it's important there be public process for these kinds of big decisions.
We all want to preserve that facility and that legacy, I think.
Yeah, but I'm happy about all the attention downtown. In the last few seconds of the program, just want to mention that we lost Representative Chris Cannon this week, passed away at 73. Mm. Smart, irreverent elected leader. I got to commute with him often to D.C. when I worked there, and I think very highly of him. So send condolences to his family.
Yeah.
Okay, that's a wrap. Shereen Gourbani, Ryan Wilcox, and Natalie Gochner on both sides of the aisle. Anthony Scoma produced the program. Thanks for listening.